We're very honoured and privileged to have Rabbi Levy. Rabbi Levy, we're in school together, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't always a rabbi. And Rabbi Levy is a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, and that's only one of his talents. He also produced his first book, right? Just the first one. The Fox, the Fetus, and the Fatal Injection. And a fascinating topic, very relevant. I know we have anybody has a medical interest and any just general philosophical interest, join us. There are books available for sale after us. They're £8. And I believe you'll be very happy to give you his blessing and autograph. We would like inside after that. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Levy is the Rav of which one? the United Hebrew Congregation of Leeds. And here's Rabbi Levy. Rabbi Levy, take it away.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Stefsky, and thank you for the opportunity to share a few ideas and to have a bit of a discussion here this evening. I've heard a lot about the JLE, and I finally made it into the inner sanctum, so I'm sure it would live up to my expectations. I want to talk a little bit tonight. You have to forgive me for being a little hoarse. I've got a nasty cold. I want to talk a little bit this evening about the journey that led to the writing of this book, The Fox, the Fetus, and the Fatal Injection. And by all means, feel free to ask questions at the end. Some people have asked me whether the book is a fictional work. You know, it sounds almost like a bit of a thriller, The Fox, the Fetus, and the Fatal Injection. But it's a much more serious book, and essentially it deals with what I call the distortion of morality today, namely that people seem more concerned with fox hunting than with issues of abortion and euthanasia. And of course, one always needs to emphasize it's very important that the government explores and has legislation on fox hunting and make sure we treat animals humanely. But what struck me really over a period of time is sometimes if we compare and contrast certain issues, we actually give ourselves quite a shock. There's been a lot of discussion recently about British values, whether it's because Dr. Rowan Williams spoke about Sharia law, whether it's due to various people that were brought up in Leicester or Birmingham or London and went on to do dentistry in Cambridge and then blew them up themselves up in the name of Islam. And people then say, well, what are British values? What is it that people are buying into? And it's interesting, some of the trailers for documentaries that have appeared recently on the television have shown pictures of religious Muslims, particularly men, long beards with their equivalent of kippot, head coverings, saying, try and convince this man to buy in and believe in British values. And then it gives you three or so strong bullet points banged out on the trailer for the documentary, and it says this man thinks British values are to get drunk, to have a one-night stand, and to be a benefit fraud. And it's a very powerful trailer, because then you say to yourself, well, how do you convince this Muslim man, whether he's been born here or whether he's emigrated here, to buy into British values? Now, whether that is the reality or not is not necessarily relevant. What is relevant is the perception. And one of the things I want to look at is not the perception, but the reality. And we talk about British values, Western values, and we've come, I gather we've now been here something like 350 years in this country, and we've become very much part of the infrastructure, whether it was the early Spanish and Portuguese Jews, or people who came later fleeing Tsarist Russia, and subsequent pogroms, the kinder transport following the Second World War. But what is it that we buy into? And why is it that the Jewish community is perhaps not as vocal as it should be? Melanie Phillips in the Chronicle this week finished her article when she disagreed with Jeffrey Alderman about whether it's good to have Sharia law or not to have Sharia law, what exactly the Rowan Williams means. She spoke about Minhag Anglia. Now, for some of us, Minhag Anglia means you get Dine Learner's book from the United Synagogue, and you discover what Minhag Anglia is. But Minhag Anglia can also mean, as Melanie Phillips describes, and she's the author of Landanistan, Minhag Anglia means is when something's going on, we remain silent. That as Jews we remain silent, we don't speak up, we don't draw attention to ourselves. And when one talks about the issue particularly of abortion, the issue of euthanasia, there's a terrible risk that one will sound like some Christian evangelical minister and one will be accused of being, in inverted commas, some Bible-bashing maniac. And I'm not suggesting for one moment that Christian evangelical ministers are Bible-bashing maniacs. But can you imagine if a person has that danger, that risk, that if they engage in that subject in a strong and powerful way, that that's how they'll be labelled, and therefore they'll feel inhibited and they won't want to speak about the issue. I think one of the things as a pulpit rabbi in albeit a provincial community in Leeds, a large provincial community of some 800 families, but nevertheless, we were not untypical and different in our build-up to the make-up to the standard United Synagogue Shuls, is that as Rabbonim, we almost thirst for questions on issues of everyday contemporary halakha. Perhaps something that the JNE has and other similar outreach organizations has been very good at achieving, to engage people, to make sure that they realize that whether it's, you know, an interest loan, whether it's a matter of other areas of business ethics, medical halakha, all these areas are governed by what the Torah has to say. Yet repeatedly as pulpit rabbis, and this may sound terribly cliche, but it illustrates the point in a very clear way, as pulpit rabbis, we seem to be bombarded on a regular basis with questions about Yahrzeit candles. And when do we light the candle? Do we light it before the funeral, after the funeral? Do we have an egg and roll when we come back from the funeral? Or do we have herring as well? I've told a lot of people the reason why they have herring when they come back from the funeral is because people like herring. Mm-hmm. They like herring. They have to have an egg or lentils. They have herring because people like having herring. And there's always this desire at the back of our mind that the day will come when we're going to get questions on much broader issues. I recently had a situation, so that it's not too easy to identify, but I'll say it was over the last 18 months, where somebody came to me and their relative was very seriously ill. And I said to this person what I've said to a number of people in similar circumstances: let me sit down with you and the doctor and the other relatives who are able to talk about your very sick relative, and we'll talk about, you know, what is their medical condition, what does the halacha say about the circumstances, because we're talking about people who are talking about, you know, withdrawing the drip, withdrawing the oxygen, withdrawing the medication from the patient. And I say to these people, hang on a minute, not everything you're mentioning to me may be halakhically allowed. And very often people say to me in these circumstances, we've made our mind up already, this is what our mother or our father would want. And it's very, very hard to make progress. It's very hard to create that partnership between rabbi, congregant, patient, and doctor. The next day, after the relative had died, the person rang me up and said, when do I light the Yahrzeit candle? Is it before we go to the funeral or after we go to the funeral? And it mattered to them. And there's famous stories of Rabbi Saul Salanter and other similar great rabbinic luminaries of the past who were asked very silly, as it were, questions, or questions that weren't really questions, but they took the questions very, very seriously. And when their pupils asked them, why do you take these questions so seriously? They said, because if you dismiss them or laugh at them, then when they have a very serious question, they're not going to come forward and ask you the question. So for the last 15 years that I've been active in the rabbinate, one is hoping that more of these questions will come forward. Sometimes they do come forward. I once had a guy ask me a question who wasn't from my shul, but I'd given a long series of business ethics questions. And he rang me up with a question. And I said to him, look, you know, I'm just one of these guys that regurgitate the material of other people. But I'm not an expert in anything. I just put together, I reformat it, and I deliver it and facilitate discussion. But I said, based on what you've told me, it strikes me that this is the outcome for the business ethics question you've asked me. And he turned around and he said to me, Rabbi, I respect you. This Shiloh has cost me £60,000. But I know you've given me the answer that's the correct answer, not the answer simply that I want to hear. You've given me the answer that's the appropriate answer. And that does happen occasionally. Ultimately, what moved me to research this area and to write a book, a thought-provoking book on this subject, was the following thing. In about 2001, Tony Banks, who was a Labour MP, he died a year or two ago, quite suddenly actually, he was the sports minister for the Labour government, Tony Banks, and he was very much in favour of the bill that was being discussed in Parliament to ban fox hunting with hounds. And I'm sure you all know this now has become the law. It's forbidden to fox hunt with hounds. It's considered cruel and inappropriate, and therefore it's against the law in this country. There was one of the longest debates. Hundreds of hours were taken up in Parliament by this discussion. It was one of the longest debates in Parliament that have ever taken place in recent decades. And not only was it one of the longest debates that have ever taken place in Parliament in the last century, in the 20th century, but it was one of the most impassioned debates that had taken place. Now, some of you that may have seen the Knesset in action will see on a regular basis people getting quite animated and excited about relevantly trivial matters. There's only two occasions in my mind that I remember anybody getting excited in Parliament, and I don't consider Prime Minister's questions as sufficiently exciting. Yes, it's a little bit raising the tempo, but it's not really that exciting. One was, I don't know if anyone remembers, Michael Heseltine used to be a Conservative politician. He came back from lunch one day, and I think he'd had a double scotch, and he lifted up the mace. You know, it's the sort of thing you see Lord Mayors carrying, that long sort of scepter or whatever it is. It's called the mace. And he lifted it up and he swung it round his head. And it was a big thing in the press, you know, of excitement in Parliament. The other thing, and you have to be about my age in your 30s to know this, was when Ian Paisley, Reverend Ian Paisley, berated Margaret Thatcher over Northern Ireland in the Houses of Parliament. And like a typical Irish preacher, he told her that if he doesn't do as he says, it's going to be all hell, fire and damnation is going to rain down. And I think he even called her a witch. And he was either told to apologise or leave the house. And this was really exciting, that somebody felt passionate enough about a subject that they were prepared to use superlatives and shout and get excited. Now, when I saw a documentary on fox hunting about how the legislation came into being, I saw Tony Banks, the then Labour MP and sports minister, keeled over. Like when a person's really annoyed and really impassioned, and they keel over and they scream with all their emotion and power. And he was screaming in Parliament, and he was screaming so loud and impassioned, he jolted himself back from where he was standing, and he was imploring his fellow MPs to vote in favour of the ban. And I said to myself, you know, wow, it's amazing. He feels impassioned about an issue. But I thought to myself at the same time, what is his view on abortion? And it wasn't the fact per se that he was excited about the ban on fox hunting. It's what would he say on another issue of human life and death? And my point has been proven, because in November, December, just a few months ago, there was a group of MPs who suggested to Parliament that they have a debate on abortion, that it should be limited from 24 weeks to 20 weeks. Now, whilst halakhically that may not solve all of the problems, and certainly as far as the Catholics are concerned, similarly, lahavdil, it's also not going to solve all of their problems. But they didn't even allow the debate to take place in Parliament. They said there's not enough evidence, there's not enough people that want the debate. They would not allow the debate. In a free democratic society, they wouldn't schedule a slot time in Parliament in order to have the debate. And when you watch Newsnight and you see Jeremy Paxman facilitating a discussion between a Labour minister who's anti the discussion to reduce abortion from 24 weeks to 20 weeks, and a Conservative MP who's in favour of the discussion, automatically in the debate, the Conservative MP is made out to be right-wing and unreasonable and coming from an unreasoned perspective. But the person who's in favour of keeping things as they are is seen as a rational, liberal, moderate, level-headed person. And we are taxpayers in this country. We are citizens living in this country. What do we, as individuals, as people that have a right to vote, that have a right to write to our MP, have to say on some of these issues? In 2005 and 2006, Lord Joffe, who I'm told is Jewish, first mooted in 2005 and then 2006 in the House of Lords the private members' bill for assisted dying. And it was defeated first time round, and indeed it was defeated second time round. But as a number of doctors writing in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, have said, the chameleon of assisted dying continues to change and mutate, and like with many such forms of legislation, there's always the great risk that public opinion will gain even more momentum, and people will continue to tweak the bill until it incorporates more and more MPs on board, and then eventually you have the debate one day in the House when there aren't so many people about, and then eventually the legislation gets through. And we'll end up like some of the other countries in the world, and the state of Oregon in the USA, where assisted dying, and in some cases actually euthanasia, is carried out. And I asked myself in 2006, what would happen, what would be the ramifications and the impact on us as a Jewish community, a Jewish Orthodox community, should the assisted dying bill come in to action? And as a pulpit rabbi, I looked at it within the context of shul, aliyot, and the Jewish chronicle. And I asked myself the following question. A guy comes into shul one day, and he comes up to the warden of the shul, and he says to him, I'd like you to give, this is fictitious, I'd like you to give, there's no one called Goldberg here? No? Okay. I'd like you to give Dr. Goldberg Schlishi, the third call-up in shul this morning. And the woman says, why do you want to give him the third call-up this morning in shul? He says, you know, Dr. Goldberg, he's an exceptional doctor. My father last night, Friday night, we went to the hospital, we had all the chicken soup and the gefilte fish and everything, all the things we normally have. We're sitting around the thing. My father couldn't eat, he was too ill. He reached the end of his life, and Dr. Goldberg mixed the barbiturates together, mixed them all up, gave them to my father to drink. My father took them himself, as the law says. Dr. Goldberg didn't give it to him, you know, put it down his throat. My father actually took them and drank them himself. 20 minutes later, he still hadn't slipped into the coma, as normally happens in Switzerland and all these other places where it takes place. And what did he do? He did what happens in approximately one of five cases. He took an injection and he put it into the line that was in his body and he gave him the final injection. He actively terminated. And you know, the compassion was amazing. Dr. Goldberg has known my family for years. He delivered my grandchild and he had tears down his eyes. He held my father's hand. He was so compassionate. Please, will you call him up? I think he should be given this honor. He's such an outstanding doctor. The warden says, you know, let me just ask the rabbi on this one. It's an interesting question. Goes to the rabbi turns white. The rabbi says to him, I'm very sorry, you can't do this. It's Yisro this week, the Ten Commandments. He says, you mustn't kill. He may not be being called out for that portion, but you just can't do it. There's a whole furore, as you can understand. Dr. Goldberg's parents were founder members of the shul, and he's very wealthy. He's pumped in a lot of money. And he set up a cancer hospital for children. And in the next week in the Chronicle, there's a whole thing, rabbi out of touch with English law, not abiding by law of the land. Did he not go to Cheder and learn how much Abraham and Sarah engaged in chesed? And Dr. Goldberg is engaged in chesed, dying with dignity and compassion, alleviating suffering and pain. And you may laugh. Do you think it's inconceivable such a thing could happen? I spoke with ministers in Switzerland. I spoke to the Av Bet Din in Switzerland and the hospital chaplain in Switzerland, and they have to deal with issues of people who say to them, they say to them in Yiddish, Rebbe, yetzich geyaheim, which means in English, Rebbe, I'm now going home. And this means I'm going to the assisted dying clinic in order to terminate my life. And it's a matter of time before they're faced with a doctor who's Jewish, who's engaged in this activity. And thank God they've been fortunate in many cases where they've been able to talk round the family or the members of the family that have to give the second or third signature. And they've had cases where people have not terminated their lives, they've continued to live on and see further grandchildren born. But I ask myself, what would be the impact on the Jewish community? What status would the person have who engages in assisted dying themselves? The patient? What is the status of the doctor who administers, who either passes or actually administers the lethal injection as happens in a proportion of the cases, what would be the standing in the community? And these are some of the things I looked at in the book. I also looked at the issue of autonomy, that is a major point where, as a religious community, we differ from secular society. In secular society, we believe in autonomy, essentially based on Kant, and further back still to the Stoics of ancient Greece, that essentially it's my body and I have a certain amount of autonomy over my body. But in Judaism, as you know, we don't believe in that. We believe in heteronomous ethics that comes from an outside being, Hashem, a divine entity that's given us a guidance in the Torah. And it's not simply up to us to decide when to terminate our lives or how to mistreat our bodies, even when we're well and able. As the Radvaz in the 15th, 16th century said, you've coined the famous phrase, the body of a person is not their own property, it's the property of the Almighty. So taking all these things together, I asked myself, what can be done, what can be written, in order to try and challenge people and provoke people to these issues. Pardon me. People ask me, what do I intend to achieve with the book? And I say to them, I intend, please God, to achieve three things. Firstly, whoever reads the book, I hope will be challenged in their current way of thinking. Or if they think this way already, it will strengthen, it will give a chizuk to the way they think already. Secondly, as I said earlier, to create a partnership between rabbi, patient, the patient's relative, and the doctors in order to discuss these issues further. And finally, eventually, bit by bit, if everybody does their own small bit, as Rav Tarfon said, the work is not for you to complete, but neither are you free to desist from it, it should gradually have an impact on the wider society and indeed governments and parliaments, whether it's here or the United Nations. You know, we talk about interfaith work. There's two approaches to interfaith work. One is to look at how different we are to other faiths, Christianity, Islam, and the Havdal Judaism. What are the differences? One also, what are the similarities? Where can we team up and make progress on? And there are areas that are very divergent, very different. And sometimes these need to be discussed, these need to be thrashed out in the right setting, like the CCJ, safe environments where there's mutual respect. But at the same time, we need to look at issues where we have a common ground. It may not be exactly the same, but broadly speaking, it's sufficiently similar in order that we can make progress and we can be a united voice. And this is something also that needs to be looked at. One of the things, when I was doing my research, a number of doctors said to me, a lot of doctors today have got to do, as many of us have to do in our professional work, CPD points, continuing professional development. So many points per year. And they said that very often they get people come to speak to them and they talk about ethics in the hospital or in the general practitioner surgery. And they say the ethicist goes away and they're not faced with the patient that comes before them in the surgery. They don't have that dilemma. And they often feel the doctors have this gripe against the ethicists, that they come along, they give the theory, but they don't have to deal with it in practice. So one of the things I did, I approached a general practitioner in Leeds via the local hospice that we have a close connection with. And the person the hospice put me in touch with is a religious Christian who has a conscientious objection to abortion, and how he deals with this on a weekly basis in his surgery, where he will get people coming to him, wanting him to give them the abortion form and to sign the form for him, for them, and it's against his Christian belief and how he deals with this in practice. So at the beginning of the book, there's an article from Dr. James Gerard, who writes how he deals with this issue in a practical way. There's another article at the beginning of the book by James Goss QC, who's obviously a barrister and also a judge, and he wrote about a case that he prosecuted for the Crown in the 1990s. Dr. Moore was accused of giving an overdose of morphine to one of his patients, and indeed he'd boasted on the radio prior to that that he would be prepared to give an overdose of morphine to somebody who was ailing and suffering. And one of his patients died, and they suspected malpractice, and he was prosecuted by the Crown. James Goss QC was the prosecuting barrister for the Crown, and he was taken to court, and he was tried with a jury. He was not acquitted. He was not convicted. He was acquitted. And many things were learned from that case, even though he was acquitted, that eventually secured a conviction for Dr. Shipman, the notorious GP, who had suspected he killed in excess of 200 patients. So sometimes the Crown may not have a successful conviction in one area, but in another area, they were to learn from either what went wrong or the failings of a jury system or the way the evidence is presented in order to secure elsewhere a conviction where indeed it is required. So those two articles come at the beginning of the book to kind of set the scene and show a rather practical perspective, both from the challenge of abortion for a GP and the pitfalls within the law when trying to secure a conviction where somebody has been accused of giving an overdose to a patient. And the Chief Rabbi graced the book with writing a very powerful foreword, both very much encapsulating the book and in his own inimitable way contributing some very powerful points. I just want to say one last thing, and that is one of the things I avoided in the book was things that are painful or what I call bloody imagery. What do I mean by this? You'll see on the front of the book a gentle picture of a fetus. Yeah? I wouldn't advise you to Google image fetus, whether you spell it the British way, F-O-T-U-S, or the American way, F-E-T-U-S, because some of the images you'll come across are painful and disturbing. And initially, I had, quite innocently, when I was drafting the front cover, I had the sort of the oval image of the womb, yes, of the tummy of the mother, with a full fetus inside, with the umbilical cord quite visible. And somebody who's very experienced in book publication said to me, he said, you know, it's too bloody an image. You need a much softer image. Because if the image is gives the impression that it's trying to shock people, people feel repelled by it. And indeed, almost subconsciously, that was something I'd already been aware of when I'd written the book. I hadn't considered the original image I had to actually be something that would repel people or be too strong an image. But I took his advice on board and used a soft image from Life Issues Institute, that's a pro-life group in America that kindly gave me the copyright permission for this particular image. And if one goes onto Google Images, one sees images of fetuses, partial birth abortions that are very, very, very painful, whether they're real images or whether what I call cartoon, they've been etched in pencil. So they're like a sketch of partial birth abortion images, extremely painful to look at. And I didn't want to include anything like that in the book or anything that was bloody imagery, words that depict that type of thing, because people will read the book and then they'll say, this is too painful to read. I can't read the book further. So what I try to do is I try to make it not lighthearted in any way, but try to soften the book by drawing on some of my own experiences I've had in the rabbinates, both when I was in Cardiff some years ago and when I've been in Leeds, and linking in Divrei Torah together with research from the medical perspective to try and really bring together some of the contemporary programs such as Holby City that have recently had one of their main characters go to assisted dying clinic and actually undergo euthanasia and the impact that that's had on the family. And I draw, for example, in the 1980s, some of you remember, there used to be two comedians, Hale and Pace. Two comedians. They don't exist anymore. You know why they finished? Because they did the pet shop scene. The pet shop scene was they put a pretend cat in a microwave. It was clearly a pretend cat in a microwave. And they squashed what was clearly a pretend turtle. And that was the end of their career. Finished. You abuse what are clearly pretend animals on a comedy sketch. That's the end of your career in England. Because people get excited. Daniel Finkstein, one of the editors of the Times, writes, and I quote this in the book, he said, "We once had a cartoon of a dying horse in the Times." A cartoon of a dying horse in the Times. He says we spent a week responding to the complaints. A week responding to the complaints. Can you imagine? So all of these things contributed to the journey that led to the writing of the book. It's, if I say so myself, it's hard-hitting, it's punchy, the chapters are short. It's not painful to read, but it's powerful in the sense that it mentioned the statistics. The statistics of abortion, for example, in the UK, are 190,000 fetuses are terminated every year. In Israel, approximately just short of 20,000 fetuses are terminated every year. If one takes the mid-range figure from the Alan Guttmacher Institute for Statistics worldwide, in the 60 or so countries that allow abortion, it comes in, and these are the mid-figures, because I don't want anyone to accuse me of exaggeration, it comes in at 44 million abortions annually worldwide. 44 million abortions annually worldwide. People are now saying, there's posters in Israel saying now more fetuses have been aborted in Israel than children that died in the Holocaust. And it's a very, very powerful thing. I don't mention that. I don't mention that particular statement in the book. It's too powerful a statement. It repels people if you say that in writing. But it's a very powerful thing. So I ask myself, you know, what as a rabbi we have a responsibility as thinking people, as Jews, a light unto the nations. This week, people got very excited that children from one school are being abusive to children from another school on Facebook. Why are they surprised? Are they surprised because they're Jewish? What's there to be surprised about? Because they're Jewish, Jews don't abuse one another on Facebook? Is it somehow that genetically we're really nice people? Of course, we have an element of and the Shama that's been influenced by our patriarchs and great people that went before us. But it's not a simple default position, like on a computer, default, be nice. Default, A4, default letter. Do you have that problem on your computer? It keeps doing the letter setting. So you have to go into the default, and you have to set it up as A4, not letter. We don't have a default, we're going to be nice. So if people aren't brought up proactively and nurtured to have good midot, if they don't get it at school and they don't get it at home as they're meant to, then it is no surprise. And therefore, as Jewish people, we have to work proactively, very hard, to make sure that we do feel the way we should feel and we do speak the way we do speak. And I look forward to the day when Middle England, which includes people of many religions and traditions, Middle England will march on London and they'll say, we want heterosexual marriage to be the norm. We want abortion to be looked into. We don't want any bills on assisted dying or euthanasia because we value the sanctity of life. And we want typical traditional values. We don't want asbos. We don't want men going to play in the park to get beaten up by their teenage children. And why don't we have millions of people marching on London to make a stand and to hand in these petitions that enough is enough? Is it that, God forbid, we're influenced by Minhag Anglia, that we have to see ourselves as, thank God, we're not persecuted in this country, we'll pay our tax, we'll keep our head down, and therefore we then rock the boat? I don't think we have to fit into that equation. I think, thank God, we're strong enough and capable enough, in the right way, in a measured, sensible, appropriate environment, to put over what is very much a Jewish view, very much a view that is shared by other world religions, to be a light unto the nations, that we should be Or Lagoyim, is something we have to earn and we have to work towards. That we're Or Lagoyim both on medical issues, both on business ethic issues, and how people conduct themselves on Facebook. We should be an Or Lagoyim. That on Facebook it should be, these are the resources we have in our school, how can we help you? These are the resources that we've got and the ideas for raising money for charity, how can we help other schools in similar situations? Something proactive and positive, rather than, God forbid, something that is negative. And please God, we should make this effort, and each person, little by little, the butterfly effect, you know, the butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the country, I'm sure you've heard it before, can cause a hurricane in another part of the world. And the same is the reverse, that a person can do a mitzvah in one area, has a ripple effect, and it can have an impact on someone on the other side of the world. Thank you.